It's the Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. The latest in the immigration debate in the U.S. is revolving around detention centers in the Southwest. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley visited one center, and this is how he described it to Chris Hayes.
Well, the first room had a series of cages that look a lot like dog kennels in which people had recently arrived and been put into them. They were very crowded. The individuals had space blankets, so you had all these silver space blankets, no mattresses, and people looking very distressed and upset, a number of women holding children in their arms. And then adjacent to that is a very, very large warehouse with much larger cages. And in those, the children have already been separated away from the parents. There was one cage that had children who were young boys who were being lined up for food. And they started with the smallest in front. So you had a little toddler, I don't know, he must have been 4 or 5 years old, up through youth that are 16 or 17.
Senator Merkley was not able to take pictures inside the facility, and the Washington Post fact checker blog noted yesterday that the enclosures Merkley was describing were in place going back to at least 2014 when Obama was president. Is holding people, mostly kids, this way dehumanizing? Does the rule of law prevail in this situation? What does the rule of law even mean? And what effect is this having on the people who work in these DHS reprocessing centers? David Livingston Smith is the author of a number of books, including Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. He's a professor at New England University in Maine, and he joins us by Skype. Catherine Boo is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and MacArthur genius who has devoted her career to writing about the people who society has forgotten. She is the author of Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity, and she joins us by phone from London. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
We're taking your calls on this also, of course, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. David Livingston Smith, you are an expert on dehumanization. Is what is happening to immigrants right now in the U.S.?
Well, sometimes it is. I think we need to be really careful and precise about what we mean by dehumanization. It's a word that's used in many different ways to denote many different things. So when I talk about dehumanization, I mean thinking of other human beings as subhuman creatures, you know, animals or monsters or things of this nature. And certainly that is happening to some degree in this country. But I separate that somewhat from other forms of degrading treatment or the use of certain sorts of language, which may not reflect a genuine belief that these others are subhuman.
In this case, there is a policy change, and this policy change is just making lots more people go through the system, and the system is overcrowded. So it's possible that the people who are working on the system are just as distressed as the people who are being put into these pens or these cages.
Yeah, that is certainly possible. And I would imagine there's all sorts of variation in the responses of the people there at the front lines in their attitudes towards the people who, by any account, are being treated in a terrible and contemptuous manner.
How does this stack up against how immigrants in Europe are being treated?
Well, my understanding is that this is really something unique. Of course, in Europe, there's massive prejudice against immigrants, a lot of fear of immigrants, a lot of fear whipped up by propaganda. But a great deal of this is understandable. But my understanding is the taking of children away from parents is something that is perhaps unique to what we are doing on our southern border.
You know, there's an undercurrent that we've seen before in our history. The U.S. put Japanese Americans in internment camps during World War II. In 2012, Mitt Romney went to Israel and said that Israelis had a superior culture to Palestinians, and that's why their economy was better. And even in the detention center that Senator Merkley visited, they were built by during the Obama administration. Is something changing now, or is this just kind of a continuation of an eruption of regular forces?
I think it's a little bit of both. So if we look back on American history, these sorts of attitudes towards foreigners, towards marginalized groups, marginalized racialized groups, and so on, have always been present. Nations are born in violence, and they're often sustained in violence. Mm-hmm. And if we look back at our history, we have a lot to answer for. There were a lot of atrocities committed against the others, those who we don't identify with the mainstream. Atrocities, I mean, most spectacularly against Native Americans, against Africans and people of color, against Asians. So this kind of attitudes, they don't evaporate easily. They've been around for a long time, but they sort of went underground somewhat. And they went underground somewhat because until very recently, they were seen as socially unacceptable to express in public. People, I think, would sit around their dinner tables or chat with their buddies in bars and things like this, but it wasn't something to air generally. I think since the election of Donald Trump, actually since before the election, since she was campaigning, people have become emboldened to be more explicit about racist, xenophobic, and misogynistic attitudes.
Is that a good thing? Is that an airing out of these attitudes that were kept in secret before?
Well, it's a good thing and it's a bad thing. It's a bad thing because these are forces which really need to be kept in check. And the more they're permitted, the less they are kept in check and the more harm they can do. It's a good thing because it's important to understand where people are coming from, what attitudes they genuinely have. You know, if you want to solve a problem, you have to really understand what the problem is.
We're going to move on from talking about specific politics to talking about dehumanization in general. Catherine Boo, you are a journalist who has chosen to highlight people who have been dehumanized. Before I get to some of the particular stories you've covered, I want to talk a bit about how you convinced editors to let you highlight people on the margins.
Well, in part by taking away the somehow dehumanizing or dehumanizing language of the teeming masses, which is on the pedestal of our Statue of Liberty, to show people in their thinking, imaginative capacity. And once you start to take populations that are often dehumanized and show individuals, it's much more difficult to discount them. But, even though the work that I'm privileged to do focuses on people who are often dehumanized, I'm really interested in how these dangerous ideas get perpetrated and when and why, apart from in wars and in times of genocide. And I'm struck lately by the usefulness, the instrumentality of the dehumanizing impulse in this era when we have so much inequality and we also have a declining supply of steady, decent work at living wages to go around. And my own reporting suggests that it really is the luck of birth and not inherent talent that determines most of the socioeconomic success that people know. So I'm interested, as wealth concentrates at the top, like it presents a practical problem, I think, for the winners, which is how do you, if you're on the happy side of the inequality chasm, how do you justify what you have? What others don't have. And to me, it seems there's every incentive to do the mental gymnastics that would allow the winners to say, I'm fundamentally different from those other people. They have lesser expectations and needs, less capacity for rational and moral action. and certainly nothing but harm to contribute to the world that we, like your people, inhabit. I should throw out that I think that pity can be a form of dehumanization sometimes, too.
What can?
Pity.
Okay.
Pity. But I also want to consider it from the politician's perspective. Like, you're Trump, you're leading a country where technological developments and other things make it difficult to provide good work for everyone. And you could either, as a politician, wrestle down that lack of decent work imaginatively, or you could attempt to use the language of dehumanization to, say, disqualify a huge hunk of your citizenry from consideration. I mean, when Trump, in a discussion, uses the words, these people, these aren't people, these are animals, and throughout the campaign, when he talked about inner cities as these lawless no man's lands, these essentially dumpster fires of urban space, there's a political efficacy to that, I think. Because he's effectively saying we don't need to worry about those people. They're irredeemably malevolent, they're hopeless. We only need to worry about us. And I think that in our current economic reality, this dehumanization or dehumanization is a really useful, expedient tool for politicians. And it's contagious. You know, what politicians say matters. It trickles down and radiates in a way that's very concerning to me.
We're going to take a break and come back and talk about what people are following, why people are following politicians, and where this dehumanization comes from. We are talking about dehumanizations. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back in a moment. We are talking about dehumanization this morning on The Morning Show. David Livingston Smith is a professor at the University of New England in Maine, and he's written some books about dehumanization. Catherine Boo is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has written a few books about dehumanization also and has devoted her entire career to writing about people on the margins. Catherine, I want to come back to you on this. One of the things you just said kind of made me think of how we need to find fault and blame in other people. We need to kind of feel better by finding fault. One of the examples here is that there are more people killed by guns by suicide than by mass shootings, and yet we focus on mass shootings here in the U.S. I think because we can easily say, well, it's her fault that she killed herself. We can easily say, well, it's her fault that she was in this domestic violence situation. But we can't. There's an innocence about people walking into schools and shooting school children that we can't find fault with.
Interesting. You know, one of the things that really strikes me is that we have, you know, we have so many of these acts of mass violence to focus on, that it's also a way not to focus on the subtler dehumanizing, the abrasion of dignity, self-respect, denial of rights at a lesser register. I mean, it consumes so much of the space of our civic life from one after another to another that I do worry that that we prefer these narratives of innocence, but also that many, many stories of dehumanization and injustice don't get told.
What is it that made you want to tell these stories of dehumanization? It was the story that you won, the series that you won the Pulitzer for, was investigating how mentally ill people were treated in group homes. What made you go there?
Because I think, how do we judge a society and its morality and its functioning if we avoid looking at how it serves people who are the very most vulnerable? And I was thinking about some of that reporting when you suggested that I participate in your show, because one of the things that I saw so often in in group homes where true atrocities were justified and atrocity and extenuated, people used the language of animals to describe individuals with these disabilities. I remember a particular time where somebody was describing to me the serial rape of an extremely vulnerable person. And, you know, so not to feel that trauma for that individual, his name was Elroy, it was the language was of dogs mating and not an act of sexual violence. And it was also treated, eventually became so common that it was treated as a spectator sport, almost in the way in the 19th century there were lynching was a spectator sport.
We're talking about sexual assault in these group homes that you were covering.
Right. And how did the people who worked there, get that language? It was the language of the people who own these homes and their way of looking at those individuals as a means of income, as opposed to human beings worthy of care, despite their disabilities.
David, I don't mean to say that when somebody commits suicide, it is their fault. One of the things that I saw on the internet yesterday were a lot of people saying that very thing about Kate Spade, who was a fashion designer who killed herself, that it was somehow her fault and that she did this to her daughter. Do you consider that a dehumanizing response, a not able to sympathize response?
Well, it's certainly a not able to sympathize response. I don't call it dehumanization because I think it's very important to make distinctions between different sorts of nearby phenomena. So with respect to suicide, I mean, really the issue with suicide is human desperation, isn't it? People who are feeling so desperate, so much in pain, that they prefer to die than to live. And to really address suicide, you have to address that sort of human desperation and misery and unhappiness. And many people are just unwilling to do that. It's much easier to medicalize suicide and to say, well, they have something wrong with them. The term mentally ill is very often a moral category dressed up in medical language. So the idea is you have to be fundamentally defective in some way to kill yourself. And that's a very effective way of creating moral and emotional distance from the very many people who perform such an act.
We have some callers. Greg from Waukesha, welcome to the program.
Hi. I very much enjoy this topic, and I in regards to dehumanization, I find it often that we I find examples of dehumanization often, but I'm totally blind from birth, and I've always said, and I'm not trying to say that I'm perfect or morally superior, but I've always said that one of the blessings of my not being able to see is not being able to see people's skin color or, judge them based on that characteristic of their life. I suppose we all can be prejudiced in other ways, and I'll admit I am, but one of the blessings of my blindness is that I'm not able to see skin color. And I also hear things. So I hear when people, like people who are blind sometimes, are dehumanized, I pay attention to that. And I hear that often. So I just wanted to provide that.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. David Livingston Smith, a friend of mine recommended the book Doing Race. In it, Hazel Marcus and Paula Moya highlight four steps to complete dehumanization. Find a group and dehumanize them, and then call them names. Blame that group for any and every circumstance. Tie bad behavior to their biology, and then get rid of them, push them off the land, kill them, whatever. And she says that anywhere you see step one, you can be sure the other steps are coming. Does that sound about right to you?
In general outline, it's right, but only in very general outline. A dehumanized group doesn't have to be blamed for everything. They just have to be blamed for enough to arouse aggression. And that description also kind of implies that dehumanization is something that happens deliberately. And I don't think that's generally right. I think what generally happens is dehumanization is prompted by entrenched ideologies that we simply accept as true because it's the received wisdom in our communities, or more frequently, it's a response to propaganda disseminated by elites that have some sort of motive for getting the rest of us to have harmful attitudes or to be indifferent to the plight of others.
Gary from Merrill, Wisconsin, is with us. Gary, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Any of the people that are being held at the border right now, the parents could collect their children and go back to their countries. Anybody living in this country can leave and go back to their country where they are citizens.
Wait a second here, though. I don't know that that's true. I think that the people who have been picked up as they have crossed the border have been arrested, and that's why their children have been taken away from them and put in detention. They're going through the court system. They just can't pick up their children and leave. I think they would probably want to, actually.
Why is there a mass exodus from the United States? And why they certainly could go back if they wanted to. If they said, hey, I want to take my kids, I'm going to go back to Mexico, back to my home or in Mexico or Central America, they certainly could. The other issue is these countries, when you criticize the United States, you have to compare it to something else. So if we compare the United States to Mexico or Venezuela or the Central American countries, I think you find that the reason they come here, they want to come here, is because this is the utopia. But they should come here in a legal way. They should break our laws. And as far as your two guests are concerned, this criticism of the United States and our laws, this constant putting down the country, they could sell off their possessions and go to these countries and live there.
Okay, so I don't think that we did start talking about the immigration debate because there are people who are in these in cages right now, and people have been arrested for crossing the border. But really, we're talking about dehumanization in general, and this is something that we have seen throughout history. So I appreciate your point here, Gary. David, I don't want to condemn actions, and I think that Gary had a point here in that people do come here because it is a utopia. It is better than a lot of countries. It's better than the countries they're coming from. So I don't want to condemn actions and not people, but how do you do that? How do you condemn actions without condemning people?
Well, I don't think there's anything taboo about condemning people. People do bad things. And when people do bad things, I think condemnation is appropriate. That's different from saying people are evil or bad to the bone. I would draw the line there. But of course, we should feel free to condemn people in virtue of the beliefs that they have that lead to the actions that they perform. So that doesn't concern me. I mean, your previous caller seems not to have an understanding of human desperation. It wasn't all that long ago that a shipload of Jews from Germany turned up on our shores seeking asylum and were turned away.
The St. Louis. They were on the ship, the St. Louis, yes.
The St. Louis. They returned to their death. Presumably, your previous caller would applaud the decision to turn them away. They were seeking the utopia, as he puts it, of the United States. People are seeking safety, decency, a way of life in which they're not constantly threatened or where they're not constantly hungry. For the most part, that's what people are seeking. It's not a big thing to pick up. It's not a small thing, I'm sorry, to pick up with your children, to leave everything behind and to venture into an unknown nation where you are suddenly a stranger.
Catherine, I'm interested in the fact that you highlighted the word teeming masses that is on our Statue of Liberty. You don't like that.
No, I think that you know, part of dehumanization and dishumanization is this rhetorical instrument for turning individuals with sensibilities and consciences, you know, blooded individuals, into an undifferentiated mass. And when you do that, it becomes much easier to deny them fundamental rights, dignity, treatment as equal human beings. And you know, my own belief is that there's no true empathy without equality. And part of when I said earlier that I think that PD can be a very dangerous thing is when it, you know, when it covers a mass of people without understanding the very fine line that divides those individuals within that group from the rest of us.
You are in London now. If you were covering the immigration issue right now, how would you cover it?
First of all, it's difficult for me as a journalist who understands the great stress of journalism organizations, particularly local organizations, to do their best work in an economically difficult context. I'll say that at first. But I think that there is a way of covering such stories that allows the human beings at the middle of it to bleed out, and it's a function often of time. We're too quick. We want to stick a microphone in the face of a person who's an extremist and hope that what they can say in this highly unusual experience, you know, not in their own native language, to allow them to make the case for their own value. We don't have the time for that. Often, and my own work is a slow, methodical kind of journalism that tries to allow the individuals whose lives are in the balance to be heard and understood, again, as complex beings and not as people who have only one thing to say.
Saeed from Green Bay, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to share my personal experience and to what you guys are talking about as crimes committed by people who are fleeing either political repression or severely repressed economic situations. In 1979, my family was escaping Iran, escaping political repression and perhaps certain death if they had stayed there. In the process of doing so, my father crossed international borders illegally and eventually found his way to the United States, where he was given asylum and eventual citizenship. But what you're labeling as crimes, when you are on the other side of this, and your life is in danger, or you are escaping severely repressed economic situations, where you're trying to rescue your children from conditions that none of us would ever agree to live in. If we were in those positions, we would not consider the acts that we're committing as crimes. We would consider those as necessities for survival. And when you are looking at a country like the United States that consumes that there's a small percentage of the population of the world, but consumes the greatest majority of the resources of the world, of course people in the world are going to come here. And by the same token, there needs to be immigration control, or the entire world will be here. So there are two sides to this argument, and I understand both sides, but I just particularly want to emphasize the idea that people that go cross international borders illegally are not necessarily criminal. These are acts that any one of the U.S. citizens would do if they confronted the same conditions of repression that some of the refugees are facing.
Thank you very much, Saeed. I appreciate that. We're going to go to Terry in Green Bay. Terry, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. Great conversation. Thank you to all your guests and everything. I think this goes down to personal responsibility and also treating others with respect. And when I say that, I mean that interpersonal communication that we have with friends, with a small group or something like that behind closed doors. If you see someone calling somebody a bad name or dehumanizing somebody or not treating them with respect even or being civil behind closed doors, and we don't speak up and say something, and we let them to continue on with this pattern, and over time it starts getting worse and things get worse. And I think that's what we're seeing from public officials nowadays, is that they were never checked by their friends or, you know, people close to them, and we get now what we get because...
Terry, have you been... my question for you is, have you been doing this, and do you still have the same friends that you had before? Have you lost friends by doing this?
I've been... More in the sense that I've been just seeing this politically, because over the past, like, year and a half now, I've been more politically organizing and stuff like that, and I have tons of conservative friends, I have tons of liberal friends, Republican friends, you know, everybody. And both sides do it, and... if you start calling people names and not treating people with respect, I think that just cascades into something worse down the road, and it fosters negativity and more hostility and more cordoning off of not being willing to someone to challenge your own views down the road because they become more hardened.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you calling, Terry. David, one of the things that that interested me about the dehumanization in history, like, for instance, in Nazi Germany, is that people seemed like they were under a spell. We talked about political leaders, but people follow political leaders. Talk to me about the kinds of influence, the kinds of spells that some authoritarian political leaders weave on a population.
Well, political leaders are nothing without the populace that puts them into power and tolerates their remaining in power, right? Political leaders are always outnumbered, at least before they have the big guns. So what they do is they appeal to us, and this is particularly in democracies, and they're very skilled salespeople. They're skilled at appealing to us. And so one of the ways that they appeal to us is by playing on our vulnerabilities, our cravings for certain illusions, and the fears that we have. So one of the things that I study is propaganda and the use of political rhetoric. And there's a very, very interesting analysis, which I've found quite useful. It was developed by a man named Roger Moneycarl, who was a philosopher and a psychoanalyst who went to Germany in the early 30s and listened to Hitler and Goebbels. And what he said was this: if you look at the style of Hitler and Goebbels, what they would do is they would first make their audience depressed. They would say, you know, Germany's been brought to its knees, we've been humiliated, we're suckers, the world is laughing at us, and so on and so forth. Once they've got the audience into the state of depression and self-pity, they would change their tune and go into sort of paranoid rhetoric. Ah, but it's not us, it's really the international Jewish conspiracy, it's the communists, it's all those people out there who are trying to destroy us, and our internal enemies who are eating away at the foundations of our society, undermining it. And once then the audience has gotten nice and paranoid and xenophobic and frightened, then the magical solution is over. is offered. We must come together as a nation, and the mighty force of National Socialism will sweep these vermin away with an iron broom, this sort of thing. And that formula really, really, really works. I mean, we're all vulnerable to that. One of the interesting things that Monique Carl argued, and I think he's absolutely correct, is that this was not something unique to Hitler and Goebbels and folks like this. This is the formula for populist leaders, right? And it's a very, very powerful formula.
We are talking about dehumanization this morning on The Morning Show. We will be back in a moment to talk more about how we can combat this. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about dehumanization today with David Livingston Smith and Catherine Boo. Both of them have spent their careers writing about and thinking about dehumanization and people who are marginalized. Coming up next on Point, fashion icon Kate Spade's death by suicide has launched a new conversation about women's mental health. We're going to explore this issue after 9. Catherine, I want to bring you in here. We've been talking about how David just ended talking about how political leaders sort of lull people into believing that there's some sort of threat against them and start to dehumanize people. In your book, Beyond the Beautiful Forevers, you were detailing people who were dehumanizing each other. What struck me about that book is that there were very few kind of political leaders seen. The people in the Mumbai slum were acting upon each other.
Well, one of the things that really interests me about this subject is the way in which the rhetoric of dehumanization trickles down. And there was a study at Stanford in 1975, I believe it was, and David would know better this literature, but participants overhear an experimenter call a study subject an animal, and they're much readier than to give that person a painful shock. There's other studies that show the same. It turns out that it's pretty easy to convince people not to see other people in their full humanity, and what you see in distressed, disempowered communities today is a lot of people who've been dehumanized for their entire lives, finding the people that they have a little bit more power over and exerting that power on them. This is what we're so well trained in our societies. And when I believe it was Gary that was frustrated that we were being critical of America, I don't think that either David and I are seeing what we're describing as an American phenomenon. It's a transnational phenomenon.
Right.
But we to feel better about ourselves and to feel that we, more secure in our position, we try to diminish the people who might be potentially coming up to take it. One of the things that really moved me when I was doing my reporting in the slums was there was a young man. He collected recyclable garbage around the airport in Mumbai, and he was treated as a pariah, as if he was contagious by the people in the public for doing this waste work. And he said, "I feel like an insult doing this work." He'd internalized that. And when you spend your life feeling like an insult or being treated like a dog, the effects are not going to be beneficial to the society as a whole. You are going to take that kind of harm that you've internalized and do things with it that are not necessarily for the public good. I mean, it's got consequences.
David, you have talked before about the role religion plays in this. You told me last week that there are two ways of looking at the world. Love thy neighbor, which is from Leviticus, And we are all made in the image of God, which is from Genesis. Talk about this dichotomy.
I'm not sure what the dichotomy is.
Okay.
Could you ask me that?
Okay. So talk about these two. Talk about these two ways of looking at the world through these two biblical exhortations.
Okay. Well, let's start with love thy neighbor. It's really a way to get a very, very important point across, which is that human beings are highly, highly, highly social creatures. And we very naturally and very readily resonate with one another. We resonate with one another's suffering. And that produces a problem for us, because it's often advantageous for us to remain indifferent to harms being done to others or to perpetrate harms. And
advantageous in what way? It makes us feel bad to actually see and understand people's sufferings?
Well, it's advantageous the following way: that we often benefit from the suffering of others, right? So when I go to the store and buy my cheap jogging bottoms made by someone in a sweatshop somewhere else, that's the price of me getting these things cheap. Or when I have my nice little cell phone that kids have died in the cobalt mines of Africa to make possible, I'm benefiting from the suffering of someone else. And so then the question is, well, how do we manage that, given that we tend to be so attuned to one another as social creatures? And dehumanization is a solution to that. Dehumanization allows us to be complicit in the abuse of others, or to actually get our hands dirty committing atrocities against others. And it's precisely because we have a tendency to be compassionate that we resort to gimmicks like that. With respect to the idea of being made in the image of God, I think that's actually an extraordinarily destructive doctrine. It's destructive because it underwrites a kind of illusion of human superiority that places us at the top of a hierarchy, and all other creatures at lower ranks. And of course, then when we dehumanize others, when we think of them as subhuman creatures, it's only that notion of hierarchy. It's only that notion that some of us are special, made in the image of God, that makes it possible to degrade and denigrate others in that way.
Yeah, we all have different views of what the image of God might be. And so what you're saying is that we tend to think that God looks like us, and anybody who doesn't look like us, we feel free to dehumanize?
No, it's just that the idea of a hierarchy in which some beings are more perfect than others, and so the idea of being made in the image of God is the idea that human beings are intrinsically more perfect than dogs and cats and lobsters and mice and rats and lice, gives us the idea of a hierarchy, from which falls out the idea that there are lower animals and lower forms of human beings.
David, as Catherine just pointed out, dehumanization is not limited to one country or even a national interest. Actually, a homeless guy said to me the other day, "Yeah, sure, don't even look at me. I'm invisible," which I thought was kind of brilliant. This kind of dehumanization, though, it seems to be on the rise. We had a fairly peaceful 60 years or so after World War II, or did we? Because we also had Rwanda in the middle of this, right?
Yeah, it depends what you mean by we.
Right, right. Right. The world.
Right. We had Cambodia,
right,
in which a quarter to a fifth of the population was exterminated. We had Rwanda. We had many, many smaller events. We had the war in the former Yugoslavia. There were no shortage of atrocities.
So, Catherine, what are you working on now? And how do we get past this? You've spent your career writing about people who are othered, people who the majority populations don't see. How do we get past this, and how do we see people?
You know, I think one way to get past this is to do a far better job at listening to those individuals. Because I think that there is no real giving voice to the voiceless. People have their own voices. We just have to do a better job of seeking those voices out and allowing individuals to be heard and understood in the round, in their blooded complexity. Because that's going to help people like one of your callers to lay off the generalizations and to start thinking specifically about those individuals as if they were his own equals.
Right.
I mean, I was thinking about that, love thy neighbor, and just it occurred to me that, is that an exclusionary commandment? Because does that suggest don't love the people who are further away from you?
Mm-hmm. Or the people who want to move into your neighborhood?
Yeah, and I'm thinking that is, I believe it's the case that the most hostility toward immigration in the United States is coming from the most homogenous populations. That often in communities where people who've immigrated are known individuals, you have less of a hatred, less of a demonization for those people. It's not always true, but I think it's generally the case.
David, the last word is for you. What do we do moving forward? Are you hopeful looking at the future?
Well, I'm always hopeful, but never optimistic.
Okay.
Right. In that, I want to change the world, right?
Right.
That's the reason for writing and teaching and so on. So that's a hopeful attitude. So look, I think there are several things. One is folks like you and Catherine, who can convey a message to a large number of people about the dangers that are lurking in the world around us. We have to remain very, very vigilant about the use of dehumanizing language and the abuses that very gradually and incrementally become acceptable in a society. It doesn't happen all at once. It happens by degree. So you all, I think, have a tremendous burden of responsibility there. We also need to understand what we're capable of and how these things happen. I teach a course on race, racism, and beyond at the University of New England, where I work. And it was very important to confront students with things that they have never learned about in our educational system. In this case, the unbelievable atrocities that white Americans have inflicted on black Americans. Mm. Utterly, utterly horrible and grotesque and blood-curdling. Which these students and the vast majority of Americans simply are unacquainted with.
I'm going to have to cut you off there, David. Thank you for being with us. We've been talking to David Livingston Smith, who is writing his next book on dehumanization. As we speak, he joined us by Skype. And Catherine Boo won a Pulitzer for her work uncovering disturbing conditions in group homes for the mentally ill. She is the author of Beyond the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. She joined us by phone from London. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Healy Boltina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman. You are listening to the Ideas Network.